Greetings, all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph, and we're today in lesson 153, 153, in Genesis 24. And we're going to go through the story of Eliezer going to or being sent by Abraham to his old home country. That is the later one, not the first one, to fetch a wife for his son Isaac. And so we read in chapter 24 in verse 1, a very interesting statement that in essence would be the epitome of all blessings that any man of God can ever receive or hope for. And there aren't many like that who can say that they were in this state of affairs like Abraham. And so we read in verse 1, and Abraham was old. In Hebrew, the word old is zaken, which means a man with a beard. And so whenever they talk about elders, a lot of people don't realize that. They think that the elders are just, well, in the old terminology, they can be young men. Well, the reality was that the word that God used, he could have used an old man, but he did not. But he used the word zaken, which means a man with a beard, because the word beard also is zakan. And so zaken, zakan, the two are related. And so generally the elders that were chosen to be elders first had to be 30 years old. That was the beginning of their ministry, like with the priesthood. At the time, you know, at the age of 20, they began serving, but it was only until they were 30 that they began to serve officially as a priest. And that's exactly the time when Jesus Christ began his ministry, when he was 30, and so was John. And as they grow older, obviously, you know, they have a longer beard, while the growing of the beard begins even younger. And so later on, when you come to the New Testament, you read about the elders. Generally, there were people that were highly respected in the community and generally had long beards by then. And obviously, the longer and the bigger your beard here, you know, is, the more respectable you were, assuming that you had the character to go with it. And so he was old. That means not only in terms of age, but also in terms of his appearance and, you know, the beard that he had. In this country, a beard may not have much of a meaning, but in the Middle East, especially in the old days, it was a sign of great respect and honor, and everybody that walked in the street, you know, when they saw you, a man with a long beard, they had great respect for you. So it has an added connotation there as a part of the culture. And so he was old and well-stricken in age. In Hebrew, baba yamim, which means of many days. And the Lord has blessed him, Jehovah, that is, has blessed Abraham in all things, you know, just a general statement. He was not lacking in anything. And that's the ultimate that any of us can ever wish as we walk with God. Well, this is in essence is the reality of what Abraham was all about. A man who totally gave himself to God in every way, was blessed in every way. And so it will happen to any one of us who is willing to walk in the footsteps of Father Abraham. So in verse 2 we read, and Abraham said unto his servant, and this his servant was Eliezer, as we read in other places. He was a servant that he acquired apparently in Damascus when he was there before he came to the land of Canaan. As Josephus tells us, that while Abraham was in that area, he remained there for a while, and he was known as the ruler of that territory because he was a mighty prince, in other words, a man with great entourage with him. Totally unlike the concept that they showed in the movie, the Bible, you know, a man with a few goats and maybe a couple of servants. That was not Abraham. And so this elder became, being a very industrious person, gradually became his chief of staff, so to speak. So it shows that Abraham was a very rich man, and when you have a chief of staff, you're talking about a household and thousands of servants, and abundance of flocks and all kind of things like that. And so he chose this one that earlier he even suggested to God that maybe he should be the one to inherit all that he has, because he's the only one that he had in the house that he had respected. Lot was already gone into the other side of the Jordan. And so he loved very much this servant, but he was willing to pass on to him everything that he had, especially due to the fact that he was childless. Anyway, he's calling upon this man to perform the most important task of choosing a wife to his son, the inheritor of all things that he has. And he wants to make sure that she's the one that fits with the divine will, since all the divine promises and covenants that were given to him are going to be passed on to Isaac. And mind you, Isaac, this time, he's in his 40s, maybe. And according to the custom of those days, it's not up to a man or a woman to go and seek a mate, as it is done in our days. But the parents who know the families, who can speak to the families within the context of the day, where the parents are the ones who are supposed to do that, and talk to each other, and they didn't talk to the ones who were going to choose, they talked to the parents of that person, and people were obedient, and to begin with, they also made sure that their sons and daughters obviously would love that person. You know, they were not going to get someone that is totally contrary to the desire of their own son or daughter. Otherwise, it isn't going to be a happy marriage, and they were not interested in that. So I have to take all those things into account. And especially when in those days, families that had good reputation, you know, they raised children that are of good reputation. So what counted is the character of the family. What counted was the good name of the family and the qualities of the family. And so when you go to a place like that, just like today, you know, if you want to buy a good product, you go to a company with good reputation. It has good products and everybody knows about it, and that's what you buy. Now, of course, we're not dealing with a transaction here, but in essence, those things were extremely important for the parents because they wanted their own good name and qualities and all that to be passed on to their children, and they cannot do that unless they make sure also that they have mates that will perpetuate the same qualities and character and the name of the family. So these kind of things were extremely important, and unfortunately as time went by, you know, and people tried, you know, or started doing things on their own, and that's when you find an awful lot of problems within the family, including divorce. Just like in the old days, as it said in the beginning, in the days of Noah, or before that, men began to choose women, you know, on their own. In other words, apart from the family, apart from the name of the family, the character, the parents, just people did it on their own. They chose women from whomsoever they wanted. So that was a mark of a corrupted society that is going down the drain. And unfortunately, we find ourselves in this kind of a world today. And this is what he says to his servant, verse 2, "And Abraham said unto his servant, the elder of his house, that ruled over all that he had," so that was the chief of staff, "put, I pray thee, your hand under my thigh." Now, what does that mean? A lot of people have some strange ideas about this, what he was really doing, having no knowledge, no understanding of the culture and what it really meant, what it signifies. In essence, the biblical terminology is that children come out between the thighs. Obviously, they mean specifically the sexual organs, especially with the men. He's the one that deposits the seed that gives life. And so that becomes a terminology and an idiom that they use. And so, since from the thighs or the loins, you know, come the children, the idea is that when you swear by putting your hand on the thigh, if you do not perform what you swore to do, then the children that will come out of the thigh will avenge the evil that you have done. And so, under this context, you know, you understand what he's talking about. That no man will do it, that is people of reputation and honor, obviously, unless they were going to fulfill it, because that becomes a very serious matter. And also, if everybody knows that you're the kind of a person who is willing to swear by someone's thigh, understanding the importance of it, then you are a person without reputation and without character. And if you are, in the old days, you were basically ostracized and humiliated and shamed by all. That's the last thing any man wanted in a society where honor was more important than life. And so that's the context to this. And he said, and you do that, and I will make you swear by Jehovah, the Elohim of heaven and the Elohim of the earth. And he's speaking specifically about the El Elyon, the Father. And of course, the one that dealt with him on a personal basis is also in that role. But he's talking about the God of gods in essence, of which there was quite a bit of information at the time. And even until the days of Christ, they still knew that there is a Father and there is the angel of the Lord, as we went through it several times. But gradually, knowledge became more and more scarce, you know, scarce, that is, among people. And people lost this understanding, and especially with the rise of, as people call it, or think, a new religion, Christianity, which it was not. People began to think in those terms, on the Jewish section, you know, the border, so to speak, or the fence, and on the non-Jewish side, where they began to think, well, there is only one God, and the Jews thought there is only one. We've got one, and you've got your own, and that's another God. And we had two different religions and two different gods. Well, anyway, that was not the understanding prior to that. In other words, the concept of monotheism of the Old Testament was totally different than what it became later on. They all knew there is a God, yes, that rules all on this earth, and he deals personally with human beings, but they also knew, including other nations, not only the fathers. Other people have already known that also, that there is the one that deals specifically with human beings, and there is the one that is the God of gods, up in heaven. And so this was common knowledge. Anyway, he says, I'm going to make you swear by this God, that you shall take a wife for my son of the daughter, that you shall not, that is, that shall not take a wife of my daughters of the Canaanites. In other words, since Abraham knew that he's old, he may die, and he cannot go and do it on his own now. And then Sarah is already dead, so the only one who is now responsible to take a wife for his son, which was also the custom, would be, in this case, the one that the father tries the most. And that would be his chief of staff. So here, even at this point, if a father is dead, the son himself cannot go and fetch a wife for himself. He still has to go to the elder in the community, and through him to request that matter to be taken care of. Of course, nowadays we are so far removed from it that this, you know, would look strange to even think about it today. But there are societies even to this very day where the elders are extremely highly respected. As a matter of fact, in many societies, as elders died later on, people began to deify them, and they made gods out of them. And you find that, you know, the ancestor worship still prevalent in the Far East, especially in places like China and other places. And so this is what he's telling him. You do not take anyone from this land of the Canaanites because of their character, because of their reputation, obviously, because of their idol worship. So these matters are extremely important to him. And that was one of the great transgressions that the children of Abraham committed later on. And God forbid them to do it and warned them against it. He says, do not marry of the daughters of the land, because they will lead you astray into idolatry. They have different character, they have different culture, you know, in many ways, because of their idol worship. That affects your culture also, the way you do things and what you believe, what you pass on to your children, and customs and habits that you would do in connection with that religion. And so it was extremely important to get as much as possible a purity in the family there, and a continuity there in terms of religion and culture and everything else. And so in verse 4 we read, but you shall go unto my country and to my kindred. And he's not talking about Ur of the Chaldean, where he originally came from, but the second place of land that he lived in Haran, where his father originally took him and stayed there and took the whole family, and they all just remained in that territory. That's the immediate family, that is, of his father, brothers and sisters and whoever went with them. And so I said, you go to there, that's my country now, and my kindred, and take a wife for my son, even for Isaac. And the servant said unto him, peradventure the woman will not be willing to follow me unto this land, which is a possibility, so he has to think about it. What am I going to do in this case? Must I needs bring your son back unto the land from whence you came? In other words, if I can't find one, should I take him back there until we find one? And Abraham said, verse 6, beware that you bring not my son back there. Because you see, all the divine promises given to him depended on him being in the land, not outside of the land. And so all the children of Israel in later generations, though they were all blessed wherever they went, and God bless them, all the divine promises that were given to them also depended on them returning to the land of their fathers. And there God was going to dwell in their midst and have the temple in their midst. And from there he was going to make them a blessing to all nations of the earth. In verse 7, the Lord, the God of heaven, that is Elohim of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my nativity where he was born, and he spoke unto me, and who swore unto me, saying, unto your seed will I give this land. So obviously, if he goes to another land, he's not going to inherit this land. So it has to be here. Now, he will send him. That is, he will send his angel before you. So he realized and he understands that, and he walks with God and he knows the will of God, you know, to know exactly that this is what God is going to do. He's going to open the door for him to find the perfect match that God himself will choose. And it's not a choice even of Eliezer. But God is going to do the choosing because God is in the process of having a family, and he's choosing the individuals who are going to be members of that family, out of which, of this family, his own son, later on, the God that is dealing with Abraham here personally, will come. And so God is involved in every detail here in that sense, to the degree that he needs to. And so he is going to send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from thence. And if a woman be not willing to follow you, then you shall be clear from this my oath. Only you shall not bring my son back there. And so the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and so he's now going to swear. And what you find here, Abraham is seated, and then the servant kneels on his knees, and he's holding on the thigh of Abraham, that is to the side, and then he swears. Today, you know, this something like that, having no background, no comprehension, understanding of that, that would look like a very strange ceremony. But when you live in that time, when you understand the importance of it, the symbolism, then you understand the importance of it, and you have an appreciation and, you know, appreciation and respect for it. So oftentimes when we study the Bible, it's very important for us not to ever inject our own concepts and ideas and feelings of the time, of the moment, of our culture, of our background, of where we came from, and based on that to determine whether it is right or wrong, you see, whether it is true or not true, you know, whether it is sane or insane or weird, you know, some people look upon it. And that's one of the major mistakes that many make when they study the Bible. The things that seem to be so far removed and different, they judge it with their own eyes of the time. And that's another way to judge God or his word or whatever circumstances he worked with. You have to be in that time and period and culture and all that to understand it from God's point of view and the man of God that walked with him. And then we read here, this is what the servant did, and he swore. And then verse 10, and the servant took 10 camels of the camels of his master and departed. And of course he loaded those camels with all kind of goods, having all goodly things of his master's in his hand, and he arose and went to Abraham, he went to Aram Naharaim, and obviously he's taking the dowry, in essence, to give to the family of the bride, and that was the custom, and still is in many societies, and still is in the Middle East, that it is, some societies have different variations of it, but the man that goes to another home and takes a wife from there, he pays the father. Not only gives a dowry to the wife, but he also pays to the father. After all, the father raised her all these years, and she's one of his valuable employees, and he's going to lose her. And So that was a part of the payment that they gave to the father also. Obviously, we're not talking about just strict transaction, you know, business transaction. We have to understand all the details that go around it. God wants it to be done this way, and so the culture developed in this direction, that a man is worthy of his labor, or he's worthy of his hire. And if a father spent all these years, you know, raising children, and now he's losing them, well, it has to be compensated, and that's God's way. Of course, today we think that's weird and strange and different, and poor parents, you know, they raise daughters, especially if you have daughters, and you spend all these many years putting them through school and everything that goes into it, and then you have later on to end up paying for the wedding, and you get absolutely nothing out of it. And that's not fair in God's sight. And yet, we have departed so far from God that we don't even think about it in this way. And then we read he went to Aram Naharaim. Aram means the land of Aram. In other words, as we read earlier, Kemuel, who was the son of Nahor, who was the brother of Abraham, he had a son, one of his sons, who was called Aram. And so Aram probably established himself on that territory, and the whole land, or that area, was called after him. That's a possibility. It's not 100% sure. We generally know that that was the pattern, that people called the name of their land by their own name. It was pretty common. So that's quite a possibility there. Anyway, that area was called Aram. And as I mentioned earlier, the people called today, to this very day, Armenian. It's Armenian in English, but it's Araminian, you see. In other words, Aram is the first part of their name, and then that means Minian, that they are from that family. A man that becomes a family, and you know, and then a nation, and then that's what you have today. And so this is one people that still retain their name, as well as the children of Israel, who still retain their name. If they are Jews, then they know the children of Judah, and whatever other tribes, you know, retain their name, this is where they came from. That's a patriarch, and that's why as time went by, people had so much respect toward the patriarch that because of idol worship, they deified the person, and it became one of their god ancestors, and they used to even talk to them and pray to them and ask for their blessings. And so he goes to that territory, and to the city of Nahor, that was the brother of Abraham. And his father gave that, that means Nahor was his brother, and the former area that he went to with his father was Haran, which was his older brother. But this one is the other brother, Nahor, and he too, he called the area where he lived after his name, the city of Nahor. And so things were in those days. And so we read here in verse 11, and he made the camels to kneel down without the city, that means outside of the city, by the well of water at the time of the evening. In other words, that's the time when everybody comes to water the flock. And that was the best place to go, because that's where you're going to meet the people that will tell you whatever information you need. And it became a social place, and it became a meeting place. And this was, in essence, the place where boys and girls met each other, you know, as they were bringing either the flocks, if they were the male, or they came to water. The women generally were, you know, the maidens that did it. And there's still societies to this very day where the only place men and women, that is young boys and young girls, so to speak, are allowed to meet each other is at this point. You know, societies that still are agrarian in nature and have flocks. You find them still in many many states, many republics of the former Russia. You find it, in other words, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, you know, all those places around there where people are still into agriculture and flocks. And there are societies there where that's the only place where a boy can see a girl and talk to her, you know, because when he came there, that's naturally you stand there and you feed, you know, you water the flock and then you talk. But any other place, it is totally forbidden. And when they read these people, you know, they have the opportunity to read this account, they can have a full appreciation of it. Today you meet girls everywhere. And that's the reason also, well, there are a lot of problems everywhere. There's no, in other words, supervision, no control, no nothing. So people do their own thing. And that's how far we've departed from that way of life. And so he made the camels to kneel down without the city by the well of water at the evening time, the time that women go out to draw water. And he said, now he's praying to God, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, send me, I pray thee, just as Abraham promised that he's going to send an angel, send me, I pray thee, good speed this day, and show kindness unto my master Abraham. So he has faith just like his master, and mind you, remember, all of them were circumcised. And so all of them were members of the faith of Abraham. Even though Abraham is the one that God called, all of his household were also of the same faith. Otherwise, they have divisions within the community and the family. And God is not interested in that. And that's also what it meant to be equally yoked or unequally yoked. And not only the mate that you marry should be of the same character and the same culture and the same religion, but also your, you know, the entirety of the household. And when you don't have that, you have a house divided. And that creates an awful lot of problems. And so that was one reason why in ancient times the servants also took the religion of their master. And if someone married somebody else from a different religion, she had to follow the religion of the master. Otherwise, they will have division within the house. So that became a part of the culture, a part of the custom. And so he's praying to the, you know, the God of his master, and he's asking him to open that door that Abraham said he will by sending an angel and giving favor in the sight of a person, leading him to the right person. You see, in other words, everything here is God sent, so to speak, and heavens are speaking here and intervening. And that's where the cliche comes, you know, you're from heaven. That means God himself up there is doing the choosing. And the marriage also, and the relationship that they're going to have, if they're going to be abiding by the laws of God, then God will be involved in their marriage, in their relationship, in their family, in their crops, in their neighborhood, you know, neighborhoods, and, you know, whatever affairs they have with the community. And so this is what he's doing here. And then 13 he says, now he's going to, in essence, ask God for something special. And he's saying, behold, I stand, verse 13, by the fountain of water. And the word fountain, in Hebrew, is eye, that is the eye of the water. In other words, the water that comes out of the ground is sort of an eye. And so they gave it that name. In English, fountain. And the daughters of the men of the city come out to draw water. And that was the custom. They used to send the girls to do it. And the boys took care of the flocks. So let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I shall say, let down your pitcher, I pray thee, that I may drink. And she shall say, drink, and I will give to your camels drink also. You see? So he's going to just ask her to give him drink. But if she will go beyond that, in which case she's going to reveal her character of kindness, of generosity, of hospitality, going all the way beyond just taking care of the requests of the stranger, even taking care of the animals. And animals in those days were treated very highly because they were extremely important in men's livelihood. And so a person that shows kindness and mercy to the person who is requesting it and also to his animals shows a great appreciation and respect and honor to everything that that person owns. And it became a very important part of the culture that a man, when he goes, let's say, to a hotel, so to speak, or with neighbors, or on a journey, if he stays with some friends, the first thing that he does before he goes inside and takes care of himself is he takes care of his animals. And a person that doesn't do it, you know, is considered to be a cruel man. And so people always watch you. They watch everything that you do. And if you do all those things, you care for your animals first, you're basically telling people, and people perceive it as such, this man is a man of reputation, a man of honor, a man of character. Of course, nowadays we don't have any of that because we live in a totally different society. So it's very difficult to know what kind of people you meet today and what are they made of. In the old days, that was one way to find out. And so this is what he's asking. If she's the kind of a person that has real good qualities and beauty of the spirit and very generous, she will take care not only of me, of my needs for water, but also of my animals. And so that seals the matter in terms of her character. And so she will say, drink, and I will give also to your camels. Let the same be she that you have appointed for your servant, even for Isaac. And thereby shall I know that you have shown kindness unto my master. So that was the test. And verse 15 we read, and it came to pass before he had done speaking, that behold, Rebekah came out, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, with her pitcher upon her shoulder. So you see how God is working out all these details. And the damsel was very fair to look upon, a virgin, because in those days when people valued very highly virginity and respect and honor of the family and all those things, so obviously, even if she's beautiful, it doesn't mean that people took advantage of her, because that's basically what immoral men will go after, the most beautiful woman, and here is a very beautiful woman and still pure. And so that also becomes a mark of respect for the family, of character. So the woman knew that if she's going to mess around, especially if she was beautiful, she had to be even more careful because of the desire in the heart of man. And she had to uphold the reputation of her own father, of her own family, of her own community, because so much depended on her actions. Nowadays, unfortunately, there is no sense of family, no sense of community, so people do whatever they want. That's, in essence, it's a corrupt society, and we just got used to it, just like Lot and his family got used to the corruption of the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, and pretty soon they begin to emulate them without even realizing it. And so we have to be careful to be mindful of these matters. And so the scripture makes it very specific. She was beautiful, and she was a virgin, and neither had any men known her. See? Not only virgin, but she didn't mess around either. You know, some people say, well, just petting or, you know, dancing pretty close on the floor and on the dance floor, you know, that's okay. And a lot of women do it with so many before they get married, and they may be virgin all this time. Well, the point is that you keep it totally pure, and that's how God wanted his wife also. Don't ever mess around with anybody. Don't even think to do it. Don't ever entertain any feelings like that. Be totally pure before me. And that's how the bride is going to be presented to Christ, as a chaste, you know, virgin, without spot, without blemish. And even a person that is known to, though she is a virgin, still to mess around with other guys, you know, necking and petting and things like that, she already lost her reputation. And so that's a part of the story. And God is specifically emphasizing all these matters and causing them to be recorded, you know, as he does later on by Moses. Because all these things have a direct link and great meaning to his own bride. And so as people would be reading these matters for many generations to come, they would be learning of the mind of God and what he wants and what he emphasizes and what he appreciates very highly and wants his people to be. And so this is what it says about her. Nobody has known her. And she went down to the fountain and filled her pitcher and came up, and the servant ran to meet her and said, give me to drink, I pray thee, a little water of your pitcher. And that's all he asked. Just give me. He didn't say anything about his camels. And she said, drink, my lord. And you see the respect there. And she hastened and let down her pitcher upon her hand and gave him drink. And she did not hesitate, and she was not afraid because a stranger. You see the openness at the time and the hospitality that was sacred in those societies and still is to this day in many Middle Eastern societies and other societies. And verse 19, and when she had done giving him drink, she said, I will draw for your camels also until they have done drinking. And that was the sign that he was asking for, and there was the seal of her character and beauty of the spirit also. And so now Eliezer knew that. And so in verse 20 we continue, and she hastened and emptied her pitcher into the trowel and ran again. Now, she was not even walking slowly. She ran again into the well to draw, and drew for all of his camels, every single one of them. And he had 10 of them. Imagine, here she's watering every single one of them. And that tells you an awful lot about character. And that gave an opportunity in those days for parents who wanted to know what kind of girls they're going to take for their sons. And so they went to that place of the well, and they observed those girls, you see, because if they're going to give a maid to their son, who was a great, treasure in their sight, who is going to inherit all that they have to make sure that the wife that he's going to have is going to continue and to be worthy of the same. And so it was the other way around also. When parents wanted to take a son for their girls, they would go to the well and they wanted to see how those boys behave there, around girls. Are they abusing them? Are they throwing, those flirtatious words that they have no business doing, or, nasty words, or immoral words toward them? In other words, that was a place for both sides of the parents to observe one another. And that's how they made decisions. So it's not that they just went to someone they didn't know from Adam and they fetched a person, a mate, either a son or a daughter, for their own sons and daughters. But they did an awful lot of checking of the background. And so they made sure that the marriage will be a happy one, the family will be a happy one, and their name and the character of their family will be continued through that relationship. And so many things go into that, and a great amount of culture developed around this place called the Fountain of Water, or En Hamayim, the Eye of the Water. And so we read in verse 21, and the man looked steadfastly on her. So he's observing all these things, holding his peace. Didn't say anything to know whether the Lord has made his journey prosperous or not. And it came to pass, as the camels had done drinking, that the man took a golden ring of half a shekel weight, and two bracelets for her hands, and 10 shekels weight of gold. Now that's a lot of money in those days. And said, whose daughter are you? Tell me. Now he knows basically that that's the city of Nahor, so he knows basically the family, the community, but doesn't know exactly which branch of the family. And so he's asking her, who are you? Tell me, I pray thee, is there room in your father's house for us to lodge in? I mean, now that she showed total hospitality, she's a reflection of the family that also will be very hospitable. And showed you how far we've departed from that. We cannot talk like that nowadays to people. We're so far from it. And that's why people are divided. And so this is what he's asking here. And she said unto him, I am the daughter of Betuel. Betuel means, Bet means house, and El means God. In other words, the house of God. That was the name of the person. God's house, like later on you read, as Jacob said, Bethel, house of God. And here's Betuel. So this is the Aramaic form of Bethel, or Bethel in English. And she says, I am the son of Betuel, the son of Milcah. And Milcah means also queen, Malkah, Milcah, the same, whom she bore unto Nahor. And she said moreover unto him, we have both straw and provender enough and room to lodge in. And the man bowed his head and prostrated himself before the Eternal, right there in the open. And he said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has led me. Speaking about when you say, read the Lord, as I mentioned a long time ago, it's always Jehovah. And Jehovah has led me in the way, that is this way, to the house of my master's brethren. So God directed him directly, not just to any part of the family of Abraham, but to a particular family and to a particular daughter. Because obviously they had other daughters beside this one. And this is what he's saying here, is acknowledging that before all. And mind you, again, you know, you compare that to today's society, you know, you would never see a thing like that. You know, it would look so strange if you see somebody doing it. And that again shows you, you know, how far we have departed from the natural way that God intended for us to have, and why God is saying in the future that God is going to make his children to be farmers and shepherds. Because so much goes into this way of life that causes people to become natural and develop proper character and be able to have the right culture that God is, the, you know, interested in, to promote the kind of relationship that he wants people to have among themselves with the land, and above all with him and with his son. And so this is going to be the future also, and you'll be seeing this kind of matters also in the future. And so in verse 28 it says, and the damsel ran and told her mother's house according to these words. And it's interesting, it doesn't say her father's house, but her mother's house, because the father obviously is not either he's dead or whatever. That's why it becomes the mother's house. And Rebecca had a brother, and his name, well, actually the father is still alive, because we read about him later on. But apparently the father is very old and he's not very active, and Laban, the firstborn, is doing much of the talking. And so Rebecca had a brother, and his name was Laban, and Laban ran out unto the man and unto the fountain. And it came to pass when he saw the ring, and mind you, what God is recording here, you know, in other words, it's something about the attitude of Laban. When he saw the ring and the bracelets upon his sister's hands, and when he heard the words of Rebekah his sister, saying, thus spoke the man unto me, that he came unto the man, and behold, he stood by the camels at the fountain. And so even though he was already invited by Rebekah, he still allows her to go and tell her family, and he's waiting there. And so Laban sees him, and he says to him, come in, thou blessed of the Lord, wherefore stand thou without? In other words, why are you standing out here? Come over, you know, you've been invited. There's hospitality here. And he said, for I have cleared the house and made room for the camels. So he already went through all that. So there was a period of time when he was waiting there. And it shows the hospitality of the time. And also the fact that he saw the ring and he saw all those things. Well, you know how Laban is, as we find out later with Jacob. They're giving greater even desire to prepare the house for this guest. And so it says, I have already done that. I've cleared the house and made room for the camels. And the man came into the house and he ungirded the camels. In other words, he takes care of them first, because that's a mark of the character also of the person. And everybody's watching it. You see, and all those things were important factors in those days. And people paid attention, you know, very close attention to it. How does a person behave? And that's how they judge them. And so this is what he does. That's the first thing that he does. Not taking care of himself, but he takes care of the camels. And he gives straw and provender to the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men that were with him. And so here's Laban doing all those things. And he gives him, you know, he takes care of all of his needs. And here again, you know, the foot washing attitude that later on Christ would speak about it, which unfortunately, you know, people made a ceremony out of it, a ritual that is a meaningless one. When Christ never talked about a meaningless ritual, he talked about the real thing. And today, you know, we just don't have the real thing because society is totally different. So now it becomes a symbolic act and no more what Christ was talking about. And the disciples understood what he's talking about and therefore did it whenever people came to them as guests that literally did those things, and that was not something once a year, a ceremony on the Passover day, you know, which a church that called itself, you know, the Mother Church had done, and then people followed in her footsteps, and to this very day others that should know better are still doing the same. And not because this is what Christ meant, but because, well, that's what people have been used to for centuries, a symbolic act, not the real thing. And that was not the intent of God. Anyway, this is what this Laban is doing here, showing total, all the way, all out hospitality. You see? And that's what Christ was talking about. The real thing. Not the make-believe thing. Not even the symbolic act, but the real thing. And so in verse 33, and there was set food before him to eat. And he said, I will not eat until I have told my errand. And he said, speak on. And now what Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, is going to tell Laban is something very interesting. He puts all things in perspective. And he's going to tell about Abraham. He's going to tell about the riches that he has. And he's going to tell them about the fact that he receives all things from his father. And so he's building it up in such a way that there would be no doubt and there would be no hesitation about fulfilling that purpose and about allowing, you know, the daughter to be given to Isaac. And so what he does is not just a dry repetition, and he goes through everything from the beginning until the end. And later on you see the same kind of storytelling by Stephen. When they ask him a question, he goes through the entirety of the story. And a lot of people that do business with people of the Middle East, they find out that they still do the same thing to this very day. Anyway, we're going to stop at this point and continue next time. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.